Hello, GIST podcast listeners. Podcast, an audio medium. But really, I've been gearing up to make the big time. Yes, the GIST is now on Instagram. We started an Instagram page. It's a way to foment discoverability. I just always, whenever I was doing my interviews, I never realized that what I really wanted was to extract a one-minute clip with subtitles and big block letters. But it's really cool, and it's a really good way to help people find the show, because people don't pass around audio, but they pass around video, and we're populating the Instagram feed. Please go to PescaGIST if you're on Instagram, or join Instagram in order to go to PescaGIST. It's Wednesday, April 9th, 2025, from Peachfish Productions. It's The GIST. I'm Mike Pesca. Dow up almost 8, S&P up 9.5, the tech-heavy NASDAQ. Can we just officially change the name to that, by the way? That was up over 12. This Trump fella is something of a genius, no? Okay, no. Follow me then. Suppose Trump wanted to impose a 10% tariff on the world. And we don't have to suppose, because he did want to do that. He does want to do that, and he did that. But after that was announced, if that was the only thing announced, Goldman Sachs and Citi and the academic economists who study such things would say, as they did on just the 10% tariff, whoa, no, this is going to shave 0.2, 0.3% off GDP. It will probably raise inflation. So the markets would punish that. So how should he do it? What did he do? He said, and I don't know if he said this or it just worked out, but the genius said, all right, I'll impose the 10% on everyone, but I'll impose a lot more on some countries, including some heavily bepenguined countries. I'll go up to almost 50% on Canada. I don't know, let's say 125% on China. And the stock market, they're going to hate that. So then we send Scott Bessent outside to say something Scott Bessent-y, and then everyone will love it. So what can we get Scott Bessent to say? How about?
And we saw the successful negotiating strategy that President Trump implemented a week ago today. It has brought more than 75 countries forward to negotiate. It took great courage for him to stay the course until this moment. And what we have ended up with here, as I told everyone a week ago, they are in this very spot. Do not retaliate and you will be rewarded. So every country in the world who wants to come and negotiate, we are willing to hear you. We're going to go down to a 10% baseline tariff for them, and China will be raised to 125 due to their insistence on escalation.
And with that, news that should have tanked the markets, right, should have shaved 0.2% off GDP, actually thrilled the markets because the specter of full tariffs would have been so much worse. Could have lopped off not 0.2%, but 2% off GDP. That is $500 billion, $5,000 per household. Trump is a hero. Trump is a genius. You know the old Malcolm X line about pulling a knife only partway out of your back and that not being progress?
If you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this scenario, Trump was the one who stuck the knife into his own back, and then he pulled it out so only 10% of the knife was still in. Or with the Chinese version of the knife, he pushed it in a lot further. But who cares? Markets are up today. Big time. You really got to hand it to this Trump fella. They love the 90-day pause, do the markets. They have every reason to believe that in 90 days, Trump will get really good at macroeconomics. He'll learn a lot. He'll study the charts. He'll read a textbook. There's really no downside to anything that we've gone through since Independence Day. It was a very fruitful period. I'm glad it happened. Great branding, too. Well, maybe one downside. All the Americans who are depending on all those manufacturing jobs coming back, sadly, they will stay overseas, and the domestic back knife industry will barely be a shell of its former self. On the show today, more on Trump's thinking and his talking about his thinking. But first, John McWhorter is a distinguished linguist and a very effectual public intellectual. His new book is called Pronoun Trouble, The Story of Us in 7 Little Words, and he is on The GIST next. We're joined once more by John McWhorter, one of my favorites. And people have been coming up to the Columbia professor of linguistics and the New York Times columnist, and they've been saying, John, you need to write a book about pronouns. And he would say, who, me? And they would say, no, whom, me? And he would say, yes, I guess I really do need to write a book about pronouns. The book is out. It is called Pronoun Trouble. John McWhorter, welcome back to The Gist.
Thanks for having me, Mike. I like that version of the story. Let's keep that for the movie. But yes, Pronoun Trouble. That's right.
And Pronoun Trouble comes from one of our great, it's not Chomsky. Who was it? Oh, yeah, Daffy Duck.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Daffy Duck. It's really from basically the Looney Tune rabbit seasoning, where Daffy and Bugs have this exchange where Bugs switches the pronouns on Daffy Duck so that he gets shot in the face. And Daffy says, oh, wait a minute, pronoun trouble. And I'm not really great with titles, but that one just jumped right out at me. I thought this book is called Pronoun Trouble. And the truth is, when I wrote it, which is now a couple years ago, we weren't talking as much about issues such as whether it's wrong to say they and them for one person and it being connected with trans issues, et cetera. I was writing tongue in cheek. I was writing a happy book. Now Pronoun Trouble almost seems more current than it did then because we think of pronouns as trouble, but I'll just take what I can get.
Yeah. Well, it is a happy book. I think it ends in a happy place. It gets through the yous and the me's and the I's. I was hoping for a whoso, but there's no whoso in the book or even a whomso.
I didn't want the book to get too long. And what's interesting is that who is on the cover. I was thinking, so people are going to wish that I did who. But I'm not sure laymen always think of who as a pronoun per se. And these days, to be honest, I like a book to be processable because there's so much to distract us, including me. And if I had gone through literally everything that qualifies as a pronoun, it would start to become not a stocking stuffer, but a stocking buster if people give this as a present. And so I wanted to keep it, you know, folks see that it's compact. And so it's not a pamphlet, but it's compact. So I kept it that way.
Are pronouns of our parts of speech, they are the shortest words, but do they have the fewest members in their part of speech family? I mean, there are so many. There's a countless number of nouns and verbs and adverbs, but pronouns we could probably put on one very manageable chart that we hang on the wall.
In English, yeah. That's not true in all languages, especially ones that are especially obsessed with levels of formality and levels of deference. You can have a few dozen pronouns and maybe more. English is definitely not one of those languages. We think of having a compact set of pronouns as just the way a language should be. And the Western European languages that we tend to learn first, or even Chinese, happen to be like English. But the truth is, we're rather pronoun poor, which is why we have to put so much burden on, for example, you, and then also they. But yeah, there are an infinite number of nouns and verbs and a vast number of adjectives, for example, and even a huge, generous sprinkling of prepositions, depending on what you call one. With our pronouns, though, really, it's just a little squirt. And it's the sort of thing that makes you end up writing a book about.
Yes, well, it's manageable. So you mentioned the formality, the usted, would it be in
Spanish? In Spanish, right.
Yeah, and come tali vous, and vous has, I guess, changed a little bit in actual usage in French. But what is, I know these aren't really decisions, but what has English lost by removing these formalities from our pronouns?
It means that in our language, unless we work hard at it, we can't ongoingly connote differences in respect, differences in our sense of social level, or even just not wanting to push so hard. And so instead of saying you, saying something along the lines of Your Highness or Sir or something like that. And we can do it. But in a normal language, frankly, most languages in the world, there are ways of conveying that difference that we're probably, most of us today, most familiar with Spanish. So we learn, if we're English speakers in Spanish, that there's tú, and we think, oh, that's how you say you. And then one of the first things you learn within the first couple of weeks is, if you're conveying deference, you say usted. There are two yous. And back in the day, when French was the language most people knew, it was the same thing with tu and vous. And you think, oh, how exotic. No, not really. If you go all over Europe, that's the way languages tend to work. English is weird in us having only lonely little you. And it used to be that you can make a difference between thou and you. And it's so hard to wrap your head around this today, but you used to only be plural. You meant you guys. Thou was what you said to one person, and it wasn't formal. Now we think of it as archaic, and we figure, well, thou, and we're in breeches, and it's probably 300 years ago, or in a bad play or something. But it used to be you look at one person, and you say, thou come here, and then you all stay over there. And that flakes away starting in the 1600s, and here we are with just you. It's an impoverished way of having a second person pronoun, but we think it's normal because it's all we know.
So there is a story that is very appealing, perhaps to us as Americans, as English speakers, about a classlessness of our society or the lack of formality. But that's not why it happened, right? That just happens to be a coincidence that the largest English-speaking country, America, was formed in a more more egalitarian way that would lend itself to dispensing with formalities. But it wasn't anyone's choice. That's a coincidence, right?
Yeah. And you want to tell that story. You want to say that we dispensed with the sense of hierarchy that the French and the Bulgarians and the Norwegians and the Russians. But then you notice right there when that comes out of my mouth, it's not true. If you went back to the 1600s or the 1700s in Britain, for example, one of the things that we would have to most adjust to is how naked class bias was and how casual it was that a quote unquote lowly person addressed a person of quote unquote higher birth in a certain way. There was nothing slangy or informal about Britain in the 1700s. And yet this strange thing happened. And there's a more sophisticated idea that it had something to do with people from many regions coming together into the big cities and having to deal with one another and that encouraging a sense of equality, etc. But no, not that either, because that exact same thing was happening in lots of European countries, and yet they kept their tú and ustedes. And so the unsatisfying truth is, unless you read the book where I present some theories that are a little less intuitive, but I suspect are true, the truth is you think it might just have been chance, because it's not any of the reasons that you would think it would be.
So as American, are the pronouns in America and in English, are they unlike European or other languages? I analogize those languages with all their different variations to this. Perhaps you've seen, if you've done any work, a 68-piece ratchet set. And every single ratchet has a specific length, whereas, you know, you could just buy a set of pliers and they're adjustable. And so America, English, our pronouns, they're more like the adjustable pliers rather than the fine, finicky ratchet set.
I really like that idea, but I think that part of it is that we just inherited the weird thing that happened to have gone on in England, because we're always trying, for example, to reinvent a plural you. And so we use yes. you for singular and plural, but there's y'all from the South, there's yous from the vernacular Northeast, and yuns if you go to Pittsburgh. The Pittsburghers always want you to talk about yuns. So there you go, yuns. And so people want there to be a y'all, yous, yuns, because that makes the language normal. You need to distinguish between singular and plural. And we're trying to do that. You can look at black slang and see some really exotic things, such as in Baltimore about 15 years ago, yo started being used not to mean yo and not to mean you, but yo as opposed to you, which these kids use. Yo started to mean that person over there, whether they're male or female, that person over there. Yo has some funny pants on. That doesn't mean your pants are funny. It means that person over there, probably a teacher or somebody we're making fun of, yo has some funny pants on. That's more of the human desire to elaborate. And so I don't think that we're hot dog people. I think it's just that we inherited an impoverished web of pronouns.
So yeah, yo is to refer to someone who is yon or hither and yon. And now
I like that.
Let us pause the conversation and say, what is the difference between hither and yon? Do you know? I don't know.
You know, that's more of English always taking it light, and this going back to when English sounded like this, because it used to be here, there, and yon. Just like in Spanish, aquí, ahí, and ayi. Normal languages don't just say here, there. Usually you have to say here, there, or way over there. And in some languages, and the truth is, this gets worse the smaller and more obscure and less written the language is. Often there are like five distinctions, like right here, here, there, over there, a mile away. That's a normal thing a language can do. We drop yon. And so English likes to take it light, not because we're the American English of Andrew Jackson and Donald Trump, but this goes back to something that was happening way back in late Middle English and then really kind of catches on after that.
You know, I've always been told by smart people, language is a tool. And one of the reasons people say this is not to be prescriptive. It's a tool. And if it works for you, but it seems like you are saying that there are many ways that our pronouns, other parts of speech, aren't really optimally working for us. And when you get to the they chapter, it's about people trying to invent that and address that need. But you just said that we always keep trying to invent a plural you. It's a paucity in our language. So how does a language, first of all, would you agree with that diagnosis? And then how does a language invent, like a tool maker might, a tool that serves the people using it?
Those are really good questions. English gets along. You know, a language can get along with even fewer pronouns than we have. There's a language spoken in New Guinea called Berik, where all they have is I, we, you, and then basically means he, she, it, and they. It's not I forget what it is, but they do fine. You know, they're, and the language is extremely complicated otherwise. It's not that they're somehow primitive in their speech or in any other way. So you can get along. So we can deal with it. However, it can itch that sometimes you have to say, I don't mean you guys, I mean just you. Or it can itch that we don't have a gender-neutral pronoun if you don't feel like being specific about it. Or if a societal trend happens where a representative bunch of people say, we would like to not be referred to as he and she, and a critical mass of people agree we would like to accede to that request. And so what happens is, this is the problem. If you're going to come up with something new, then you can't just make it up. It's fine to make up pronouns like Z that in groups of people might use, but it's never going to get beyond that because pronouns in a way aren't words. They are gestures. They're so deeply set in our minds. And so if you're going to come up with a new one, you have to make it up based on material that existed before. It's very Darwin. And so maybe there are pronouns in other languages that you might grab if you're desperate, but they have to be pronouns. You can't just make up something. And what that means, especially a pronoun, you might, if you're Japanese, you know, you say boku. Boku means I in Japanese. It's one of about 15 ways of saying I. It originally meant servant, but nevertheless, it made sense to use that word servant to mean I. They didn't just make up some little grunt like V to be the pronoun. You just can't do it. So we end up doing things like saying you all. Or we end up taking they and using that as the gender-neutral pronoun because it's the closest equivalent. And that's the best that it can be. And so what we're watching is an attempt to have English be more precise in that realm because languages tend to do that just because. But it can't be by just yanking something in, as colorful and as interesting as it may seem. And that's why we're so frustrated about they, because we're not used to hearing they used as in, my girlfriend is in the hospital and they need a haircut. That's different. Mm-hmm. And you have to wrap your head around it, especially if you're past a certain age. But if you want it to be my girlfriend's in the hospital and Vaguki wants a haircut, it'll never work. We can't accept Vaguki. We can't accept Ka. We can't accept Heesh, as they tried in the old days. So clever. He and she, Heesh, you want that to work, but it can't. You can't.
If I can interrupt, why did Ms. work then?
Because Ms. responded to a very specific need, and Ms. is not a pronoun. It is an appellation, and so people decided, right. Let's. And also notice, Ms. was a variation on Mrs. If they had said, instead, what we're going to do is we want to say gaboos for you know, women to not specify if they're married, it would never have caught on. Ms. felt like a variation on something else.
Yeah, and I would say a couple big gatekeepers at a time when gatekeepers were more important, like the magazine and then the New York Times saying we are going to endorse this. And they weren't leaders on this. This had been been bubbling up in the women's movement. It was more natural. Another factor is I guess we could, if we put our heads to it, think of quickly talking in a sentence where the use of miss or misses might be misleading. But of course we could do this with they. You know, Tanya and John came to the apartment and they wanted pizza, but they wanted asparagus is a very confusing sentence. If we had used he and she, it wouldn't be confusing at all. And there are these sentences that come up. You talk in the book about a written piece about Judith Butler, who uses they. And it was very hard to parse. Now, you also say your children, I don't know if they're reading about, you know, famed feminist scholars in The New Yorker because they're young girls, but your children are very easy and adept with using they. Would they, meaning your plural two daughters, have a hard time parsing that written portion that you included in the book about Judith Butler, do you think?
You know what? Yeah. And I think that this is something that I didn't include in the book, but that I'm going to start calling for, which, you know, probably won't catch on. But if that article about Judith Butler had been a conversation and you're going from one little context to another, the theys probably would have panned out naturally. But in print, I remember reading that in particular and thinking, this is a very interesting article. I respect that Judith Butler wants to be called they, but this is hard. And I thought what would have solved it is just to capitalize the T when it's referring to an individual person. If we do it with I, which frankly never made any real sense and was just based on the fact that it was easier to parse in print. Well, why not with they? Because if we're going to keep it, it would really have solved the whole problem for me reading that piece if they were capitalized when it referred to the single person, as opposed to all these French people surrounding her where, you know, they were theys too. So that's my, you know, that's my futile suggestion for this decade. And, you know, maybe it'll catch on.
Yeah. While traveling in Brazil, where they had helped organize a conference on democracy, I mean, that they really can refer to Brazil or Judith Butler, right? You speak in this way, the woman replied, they listen to you. And if they listen to you, they will stop defending Israel. Like, who is the they in that sense? There were landmines of they. 75, I looked up the original article, 75 uses of they. And I have to say 35 of them made me stop and say, and do mental math in my head, which is not how language is supposed to work.
No, and I should say that it stuck out for me so much because the New Yorker is so very conscious of elegance of prose. They work hard on it and they succeed. You know, it's the most buttery English prose I'm aware of. And I thought, if this is the best they can do, then I wonder if we could make sailing a little smoother. Yeah.
Yeah. But you're in favor of it. And you have many sentences in the book that were once pointed to as, well, this is an incorrect use of they as a plural. And that doesn't, maybe 90% of these do not seem odd to our ear. Every nation have their refinements. Now, to me, the have is weirder than the there in that sentence. Neither gave vent to their feelings in words. Everybody will become of use in their own fittest way. I would say the vast majority of people, because everybody and somebody, or especially none, which I guess supposed to mean no one, doesn't strike people as singular these days.
Exactly. And I mean, a lot of those sentences, you're talking about this collection of oldie sentences that I got from some guys in, I believe, 1895, and they're talking about all of these things as wrong. And it's these beautiful, elegant sentences from all these people with three names and Jane Austen. You would never think there was any problem with them. And they don't like just the grand old singular they. So tell each student they can pick up their paper after 5 o'clock. And I think there has always been a cohort of people who insist that that's somehow wrong. I would say 99% of them probably use it in speech all the time, but they say that it's not something that you should write down. And the ice was thawing on that starting in the 21st century already, because it's just something somebody made up in the 1700s that kind of got around. But really, English has done that since Chaucer, using they in the singular, because it feels right. And now that there are people who are saying that they want a non-binary pronoun, you could think of it as a short Darwinian natural selection step from something that we were already doing. Although it's a challenge to use they to mean someone specific as opposed to someone indefinite or hypothetical, but not such a challenge as if somebody decided to make the new pronoun foe, that would have been frankly impossible for most people.
And is that essentially what happened with Latinx? It just never had the buy-in of the Latino and Latina people?
That's one of those things where I don't know if Latinx would have been impossible if a critical mass of Latino people were deeply, viscerally committed to pulling attention away from the gender binary. But the fact is, for better or for worse, the vast majority aren't. I live in a very Latino neighborhood. I have never heard a single person who I live among in 10 years use Latinx. It's something I only hear in academic and artistic places. And you know, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, it's going to be right. A kind of a jargon. It's not an insult to say Latinx, but it is never the guys in the barbershop across the street, the women who run the hair salon up the street from them, or even the school principal three blocks away. She's never going to say Latinx. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that either.
I was wasn't chafing against Latinx a few years ago. I was saying, all right, maybe if this is going to be the new way of talking, I'll try to say it. And then I came across Filipina X. And I said, okay, this is, I can't, that's a bridge too far. I do not even understand why Filipinos and Filipinas start with an F, but the Philippines starts with a PH. I have a theory, by the way. Do you know the answer to that?
Well, roughly, for some, I've never looked into it, but yes, in terms of the ethnicity and the language, you use F, but you use the PH from when it was named after King Philip 600 years ago. I'm not sure when that was decided. That's a good question.
All right, that's possibly the greatest natural cliffhanger I've ever created on the show. Tune in tomorrow where we will talk, John McWhorter and I will talk about the whole they-them thing, but quite crucially, why a Philippine is with an F, but the Philippines are with a P, and so much else. Join us tomorrow. John McWhorter, author of Pronoun Trouble, will be back. And now the spiel. Donald Trump spoke outside the White House today, surrounded by a phalanx of race car drivers. The questions turned to tariffs, and Trump put the pedal to the metal.
No other president would have done what I did. No other president. I know the presidents. They wouldn't have done it.
He knows them. He knows all of them. Chet Arthur, Millie Philly, all four Johns, both Johnsons, both Harrisons, both Franklins, Delano Roosevelt, and Pierce. Don't forget Pierce. And none would have done this. And you know what? I think he's right. I believe him. So what we hear is that the president has started with the truth, and I will tell you, he will end with the truth too. But before that, he got into the world trade picture.
Last year, China made $1 trillion off trade with the United States. That's not right. And somebody had to do it.
We also bought $1 trillion worth of goods from China, which would have cost us something like $2 trillion had they not been made in China.
We have $36 trillion of debt for a reason. We don't have it there for fun. They have it for a reason. And
I don't know. It's a little bit of fun thinking about, say, $1 trillion stacked end to end, going to the sun 40 times. I mean, it'd probably get singed when it got to the sun. But still, $37 or $36 trillion weighs six times the weight of the Hoover Dam. Also, true, we don't have it for no reason, but one reason that we have $36 trillion in debt, about a quarter to a fifth of the reason, is that during Trump's first time in office, he added $8 trillion to the national debt. The president then segued into an area very comfortable for him. Where do immigrants come from?
And there were people from mental institutions, insane asylums.
Loony bins, funny farms, Daffy Day spas.
They were taking their mentally insane, and they were dumping them into our country.
Just as the Chinese were dumping steel. So what we're going to do is we're going to tariff them for dumping the mentally ill. For every one insane Guatemalan they dump, we're going to charge them 1.25 insane Hondurans. That is Liberation Day.
And think of it. They take over. They want these people coming back. Tren de Aragua from Venezuela to Venezuela jails that cut off the fingers of a man in Colorado. They cut off his fingers because he called the police looking for help. They said, did you call the police? He said, yes, I did. Put your hand down. And they cut off the fingers. This is what they want to bring these people back. Now,
What this gang did, when you think about it, was impose a 10% finger tariff. They cut off one pinky. Then the rival gang retaliates. They raise it to 125% finger tariff, which is 10 fingers and 2.5 toes. I say, can't you take the toes first? But the answer is no. No, you can't. Also, little note to you, if you're ever in that position, when asked by a Venezuelan gang, did you call the police? Say no. Say no. Try it. The president then returned to more explicitly economic issues.
Yeah. If you look at Apple, Apple is going to spend $500 billion building a plant. They wouldn't be doing that if I didn't do this. They'd just keep building them in China.
Here's what Apple actually announced.
Apple is planning to temporarily source more iPhones from India to send to the United States in a bid to offset the impact of President Trump's tariffs on China.
Trump was then asked if he'd consulted with any heads of industry or top bankers.
Well, I watched Jamie Dimon on Maria Bartiromo's show this morning, and he was very good. He said that, actually made the statement to effect that something had to be done with the tariffs and trade. He said that. He said, look, you know, at some point, but he said something has to be done with tariffs and trade. He understood. He's very
Here is what Dimon actually said. Note his description of the Trump administration's understanding of its own plan.
So what do you think about the tariff plan?
I think it is perfectly reasonable for someone to say that trade was unfair. There were unfair trade things. And remember, it's not just tariffs. It's tariffs. I think they have the VAT wrong, how they understand it. And I think they should really get a better understanding to make it easy to negotiate. But there are all these non-tariff barriers around food and energy and then subsidies, which, you know, China's famous for. So it's totally reasonable to say we want to make trade better. But I also want to point out to the Americans, we have the best economy in the world. Our GDP per person is $85,000. China's is $15,000. So you got to put a little bit in the context. But, you know, and then, of course, when they put the tariffs in, it was way beyond what people expected. That will cause a little inflation, slow down growth.
Yes, so quite the opposite of an endorsement. And finally, the president concluded by answering how he knew which companies deserve a break.
Just instinctively, more than anything else. I mean, you almost can't take a pencil to paper.
And that, too. Not being able to take pencil to paper, that ranks as fact check true. And in the final few moments, he turned to the race car drivers next to him and analogized their job to his, saying, I could say, here's a wall, I'm going to go through it. Sometimes you have to be able to go under the wall, around the wall, or over the wall. These guys know better than anyone. And they all nodded because it's easier than saying, we're IndyCar drivers, not the cast of The Road Warrior. What the hell are you talking about? And with that, the president strode off, having overseen a hugely successful policy that only led to 4 straight days of trillions of dollars worth of losses. He then, in the tradition of any IndyCar driver who crashes headfirst into a wall on the first turn, took his victory lap. That's it for today's show. The Gist is produced by Corey Wara, working late, and Michelle Pesca, working later. Later, Oom Peru Gee Peru Doo Peru, and thanks for listening.